Hi, and welcome back to the Mob Mentality Show. I'm Chris Lucian, and this is Austin Chadwick, and here we are joined today by Rob Myers. And we're going to talk today about Next Agile, Mob Van, BDD, TDD is dead, question mark, and leadership and technical practices. So we'll have an interesting show for you, but I think today, first off, let's get started by having you introduce yourself and talk a little bit about what you do and why and how it's related to mob programming.
Awesome. Hi, I'm Rob. I mostly do technical agile training, things like test-driven development, certified scrum developer, and behavior-driven development. My background, I had the opportunity after about 10 years of being a professional programmer, I got the opportunity to work on my first extreme programming project in 1998. So, from then forth was completely sold on these practices.
Awesome. Nice. Right on.
Okay. Let's just get right into it and we'll okay. Start talking about our first topic. So, Next Agile, Mob Van, BDD.
Yeah, and Austin put the funny names on there.
Yeah.
We were talking earlier.
Maybe reiterate.
Yeah, so this has come up for me recently because being an old extreme programming guy and thinking, oh yeah, these are great practices, I sort of ask myself every once in a while, well, what's the next generation, so to speak, of an agile practice? And one of the things I found through teaching things like behavior-driven development, where at the end of the course, we have people work in teams on their actual product with the product people, with the testers, with the developers, all there together. And one of the things that I've noticed oftentimes is that they end up mobbing.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. And once the course is over, oftentimes they will say to themselves, well that was useful. There wasn't any, you know, we didn't have to play telephone tag or telephone with each other all the time. Yeah. So there's that immediate communication. And so I started thinking, well, you know, what is there anything left that from traditional agile practices like or agile frameworks like Scrum that still needs to be there, or what gets dropped? For example, if you're mobbing, do you need to have a daily?
Sure.
Maybe not.
Yeah.
If you're doing behavior-driven development, do you need to be planning? Maybe, maybe not, depending on what else you bring in, you know, continuous delivery and that sort of thing. So it's like, you know, is there any one perfect agile practice? You got like, you know, Mobban and that sort of thing in there. And what was the one you mentioned earlier?
There was Zanpan.
Yeah. That's a hashtag I discovered on Twitter, and it seemed to be really big in France, but it's extreme. It's a combination of extreme programming and Kanban.
And Kanban.
And so I was like, yeah, well, we pretty much technically do that, right?
Yeah.
you'd have to argue pretty hard to say that we're not doing Zanpan, so
yeah.
And that was kind of an interesting thing.
Yeah. And you're doing mobbing instead of pairing, but mobbing includes pairing.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And then, yeah, I mean, you know, if somebody is out sick on a three-person mob, then we have a pair, like, right?
Like you saw today.
Yeah.
Exactly. I guess the thing that I'm wondering about in that respect, and I've been trying to, you know, play with this idea, and I'm going to do some sessions at a conference eventually on this, is, well, do we really need to come up with the whole structure, or do we need to identify, you know, what sort of benefits and what sort of synergies, if we will,
sure,
in air quotes, we would have around particular things like, you know, doing mobbing and doing BDD and do Kanban versus and doing some you know, continuous integration or continuous delivery. Do we go that far, or do we need to just back away from that? And, you know, it just depends on the team and the product that they're building, I suppose. But
but
giving people the tools to examine that and not have to settle for one prepackaged, shrink-wrapped, and, you know, with the bow on top of it.
Well, and everybody's at a different place, and so if you just said this is going to be an incremental journey, discovering where you currently are is kind of the first step in that journey, right? Because then you can say, what's that one little piece that might be the next new thing that we try and add to this, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Awesome.
Exactly.
Cool. Yeah, and I think it ties to, forgetting the name who said it, but it's kind of like, agile is dead, long live agility, kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
Where it's I think he was reacting to where someone's like, hey, this works for us, and they give a name to it, mob programming or Scrum or any, you know, any
Agile framework for the enterprise.
So any set of practices, like concrete practices that prove to be helpful, and then they're like, oh, this worked great for me, and then they share it, and then someone else tries it out, and they, instead of taking an Agile mindset with like the principles in the Agile manifesto of inspecting and adapting, and they treat it more as like a rule book, right?
Yeah.
And so it's like taking that un-agile mindset and applying it to, so to speak, agile practices, right? So it's more essential than any cool practice that someone used and found useful and that you want to try out is you approach it with an agile mindset, right?
Sure.
Which is where, hey, this is an experiment. We're going to try it.
Mm.
And then we're going to iterate it. And maybe we'll come up with something better than what so-and-so tried over at this other company, right? And so,
yeah.
And so it's like names have this double-edged sword, right? You give a name to something, it makes it easier to talk about it, but then some people treat your definition as like the rules for that thing.
Yeah. That agile mindset thing, and then of course there's the question of what do we mean by agile mindset, always makes me think about how there's the theoretical or the abstract notion of a thing, and then there's the concrete notion of the thing. And as an engineer, one of the things that I've struggled with is to convey one or the other to people who are, you know, thinking in terms of one versus the other. All that wrapped up to say, even though we talk about the agile mindset, one of the things that I always like to point out is that there is a practice that could kind of be the defining agile practice, and that's the retrospective, because that's where you look at the way that you're building things. You know, it's not supposed to be a critique of the product or a critique of the team. It's supposed to be a critique of the way.
Yeah.
Right? So that's the thing that you don't want to drop, because that's the reflection upon, well, what are we going to do? What are we going to change? You know, it's very empirical. And that's the agile mindset, is an empirical mindset. It's a scientific, you know, scientific method or however you want to phrase it,
right.
That's the kind of thing that you're doing with those. Yep. So,
yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah, so I think the one last thing on that is, you know, we promote mob programming, but inspect and adapt and come up with something better.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not like this is the standard and this is the way it shall be from then on forever.
Well, you know, and I got to tell you, when I first heard about mob programming, I was, of course, you know, completely sold on pair programming.
Sure. Yeah.
Completely sold on it. And when I saw mob programming, I'm like, that almost seems too excessive. But nowadays, I think to myself, no, the harder the problem, the more eyes should be on it.
Yeah.
Or the more it needs to communicate, the more eyes should be on it. And then the question is, if the whole team doesn't have to have its eyes on it, or if a pair doesn't have to have its eyes on it, is it so easy that you shouldn't even be doing it?
Yeah. That's my argument, is that, you know, if you, anytime that we maybe have a mob say, oh, well, maybe we should all just split up and do this all on our own. And I'm like, well, could you write a generator for that, or an interpreter for a DSL that could do that work for you? Right. Like, and so that was just kind of a funny thing. Cause we in the early days of mobbing, we never said, hey, let's split up. And then like almost immediately after we like started growing the team, it was like, hey, maybe we should split up now. And then we realized, like, hey, it's something that should be automated, right? Like all the way through. And then I kind of really felt like automation of the things that can be done by one person is actually a pretty good thing to at least evaluate before you go down to one person doing something.
Yeah. So how big is the biggest mob that
you've
seen correctly?
Yeah. So the one that I've seen that was most interesting at a conference was one of the attendees had a key to a beta for the D-Wave quantum computer. So there are a lot of people that were like, hey, well, you know, so there were about 20 people in the room, and everybody had like minor bits of knowledge in every little category. The language, I guess no one, we were writing in Python, no one at the time had any experience in Python. And so there were a lot of people doing research and things along those lines. So we had one person entering code into the keyboard, and then we had, you know, maybe five or six people all looking up stuff about Python. And then a few, like two people that were basically like had been following quantum computing, but never had any practical experience. And then everybody else was either looking something up or discussing the problem. And then we were just trying to implement something that, that basically everybody rallied around because it was interesting, right? So, and that was really cool because it was like, it was a genuine mob where, there was about 20 people contributing all at once, but it was like a really hard problem. Like,
yeah.
It was basically no experience in the room for, 90% of the work that we were doing. And we were just trying to get this thing like up and running. In practice, I've seen kind of rotations of like 7 or 8, like from like day to day, like production, deliveries on things that were just really complex or hard. Again, it's like big discovery phases. And then, you know, I think from time to time, I think things go down to 4 or 3 at kind of like a norm of like producing quality stuff that doesn't break often. Mm-hmm. But usually, yeah, when it becomes like extreme experimentation, then the mobs can kind of grow unbounded in my mind. That's kind of what I've seen. And people aren't bored because everybody's kind of going off in a different direction and then merging the ideas and going off in a different direction and merging ideas. Really entertaining.
Yeah. Cool. Ready for next topic?
Yeah. Sure. Let's move on.
Move to done.
Do that. And
nobody's ever asked this question before.
Yeah. Is TDD dead?
Yeah. There you go. So what do you think, Rob?
Oh, gosh.
Yeah.
Why are you asking me?
No. Yeah.
You know, it's actually a question that I've asked myself in the past because obviously I'm kind of, well, I'm actually, I can pitch my book.
Yeah.
I'm working on a book. 2021, it's supposed to come out.
There you go.
If I actually get my button gear.
We'll link it in the show notes in 2021.
You can link to the Goodreads page and encourage me to actually get my button gear.
But not in 2022, so you have to finish the book by 2021, or we'll link it in the show notes.
Okay. There we go. There we go. So the book is called Essential Test Driven Development. So obviously I have a little bit of a, you know, stake in the game.
Yeah.
But I do ask myself every once in a while, you know, well, what is it? Is it, it's been around since extreme programming's been around,
right,
at least,
yeah,
which is, you know, 1996-ish.
Right.
So the same length of time that Scrum's been around. So you have to kind of ask yourself, there's not a whole lot in the software industry that's lived that long.
Yeah.
But in my feeling is that it's still very viable and still so extremely useful for most things. And until somebody can show me something that is better,
yeah,
then I don't know what, you know, and maybe quantum computers will change that, but I still think there's a role for test-driven development, even with the quantum computers. And so, you know, people say, well, BDD or TDD, right?
Mm-hmm.
Should I be doing BDD or TDD? I'm like, well, you know, actually, if you look at the way that we teach behavior-driven development at Agile for All, which includes test-driven development as part of that process.
Yeah.
So behavior-driven development is the customer-facing, if you will, the product description is there. And then test-driven development is developers building sort of an engineering specification. And those can overlap a lot, or you can push it one way or the other, depending on the team, right?
Yeah.
If your team is very technical, or if you're building something like a library or
API,
thank you. That was the TLA I was trying to think of. You know, then maybe you're doing all test-driven development, or most test-driven development. And on the other hand, if you say to yourself, well, those scenarios in behavior-driven development just covered everything that we need to know, you don't have to use the other thing. So it's kind of you get these, it's like your tools in your toolbox.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right? Test-driven development is... again, I just haven't seen anything like it. I do notice that I've had, in fact, just last week and the week before, I had quite a few functional programmers, good functional programmers, in my test-driven development course,
mm-hmm.
And they were not struggling with the notion of doing testing first at all. What they were struggling with a little bit was, do they need to use mocks for things? And my mocking example just fell apart in their laps. They were like, well, you wouldn't even mock that. And I'm like, oh, yeah, you're right. You wouldn't even mock that. But somewhere along the line, you have to check that you're calling this third-party function. Okay, mm-hmm. So where is that going to happen? How are you going to, if you needed to test that, how would you test that?
Yeah.
And it still became relevant, but it was like all of the stuff that I had added into this object-oriented lab yep, for them yep. to do just kind of fell apart. Right? Right?
Yeah,
it's like, that's all over there. I can test all of that independently and then test that I'm passing. You know, it was kind of funny. So nice. It changes, but I don't think it dies.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, I think it kind of spins off what we were saying earlier, which is, you know, try it out, inspect, adapt, and iterate on it and make it better and better. And I for one, found so much value from test-driven development. And I think there's actually been a couple threads on Twitter recently about like, oh, is it dead and how come you're not doing it and that kind of thing. And I feel like, to steal an analogy from Bob from the Metacast, actually from Josh from the Metacast podcast, he was saying like, he was used to talk about Agile. Agile's like a machete, right? You can hand it to someone and they can be untrained and say, oh, I'm doing Agile and swing it around and cause a whole bunch of damage, right?
Yeah.
You know, and I feel like there's this, like when I first learned about Agile, it felt very ethereal and hard to understand, and there's this process of learning that takes a while, you know what I mean, to kind of develop the habits or kind of see things in that way. And I feel like there's that same kind of learning curve with test-driven development. And I think if you don't give it enough experimentation time, mm-hmm. you'll throw it away without even really understanding what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And so I feel like that's one aspect of it. And another thing I saw on Twitter was how it's presented. Like someone was saying like, well, what I usually see developers do is they'll go to management and say, oh, should I be doing this TDD thing? And they're like, well, what is it? Well, I have to write twice as much code, and it's code that doesn't go to production. And the manager's like, well, why would you waste time? Let's just skip that. You know what I mean?
Yes. Sell it, why
not? Yeah, yeah. And so I feel like that's mm-hmm. most of the reactions I've seen that are negative to test-driven development, it's they have a partial understanding of what it is. And that's not everyone, but that's the large majority of what I've seen.
Yeah.
That's why even the question is raised. You know.
Well, and it's the sort of thing, it's like any other discipline. I use the word discipline very specifically to represent a habit that is beneficial to you and others.
Mm-hmm.
And it can take up to a month to actually get something to become a habit. And you won't do it unless you see some value for yourself in that habit
sure.
as well.
Mm-hmm.
And it can take up to a month to get used to the notion and figure out why it's useful to you. You know, so what people, and it's hard. It's got an overhead. It's got twice as much code, actually more like three times as much code, right? but it's very simple scripty code. You know, it's you know, you can have an elaborate object-oriented or functional coolness, all sorts of crazy things going on in there, design patterns and yada yada. But really, when you're writing the test, it's like lockstep script, given when, then, boom, 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 you know?
Yeah.
So it's really simple code. But that notion that you're doing that work, it's actually work that you would already be doing. It's just that you would mostly be doing it up here, all you're doing. And then what's hard about it is that you're recording that. You're like, ah, okay, now I record it. Well, if you get used to it after about a month, you think about it and record it at the same time.
Yeah.
Or you discuss it and you record it at the same time.
Yeah.
So it really doesn't take any extra time. But it's going to take extra time until it doesn't, you know?
Yeah.
So if you were a developer that wanted to bring test-driven development to a leader, what would you tell them to say? Or what would you have that person say to that leader to sell it, right? Because we're talking about selling it poorly. How do they sell it well?
How do they sell it well? I would say you have to get to the. And by the way, you just moved us on, which is great. That's fine.
Yeah, okay, we can go.
They overlap because that's the way, you know, everything seems to overlap, right?
So,
yeah.
So that topic's from the top down. This one's coming from the bottom up.
Yeah.
Right? So
exactly.
Your question is like a developer interested in doing.
He's trying to pitch it.
How do you talk
yeah.
about it with management,
yeah.
right? Yeah.
They
yeah.
say I have to write twice the code and it doesn't go to production.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I have a little bit of an easy time with this. I know developers don't because they're
yeah.
essentially coaching up, but they need to something terse and something simple that they can communicate the business value, right?
Mm-hmm.
The business doesn't want to know it's cool, it's fun. the business wants to know how, what benefits they're getting out of it.
Yeah.
Well, you know, a reduction in defects, it's not just a reduction. So I talk about TDD and BDD as having three levels of value. It's the immediate value that we often talk about, which is, you know, test-driven development can keep you from making the dumb little mistake that we all have made in the past. And if it catches, I think Jim Shore estimates that it catches like 12 of his own little stupid defects a day.
Yeah.
Right? So that's 12 defects that, they're little stupid defects, you know, greater than or equal to when you meant greater than or vice versa, but are huge defects in the production. So there's that level. And then, of course, if you've got this, if you've built this safety net of tests of one form or another, fast test around your product, then you can change your product.
Yeah. Yes.
And that's kind of that's the promise of Agile, isn't it? I mean, if we were just going to ship the thing, version 1.0 was perfect and never make any changes to it, none of this stuff would even matter.
Right.
But no one's ever been able to do that. Except maybe, you know, some stupid little app that you know, the Iowa caucus. So
thought we might go that
way. Yeah, I felt it. I felt it at the beginning of the show. Yeah.
Now I'm just, we've dated the whole thing.
Yeah.
So people 20 years from now will look on this and go, the what?
Yeah.
There's no such thing as an Iowa caucus.
All right.
So there's that, you know, that ability to change your product. And the third one is the kind of thing where you really have to have, it's really hard to convey this, especially if you haven't actually experienced it for yourself, which is teams after about 6 months worth, and maybe some of your teams have experienced this, where after they've got that safety net, they're trusting that safety net, they're moving fairly quickly through their backlog or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
And they're all of a sudden somebody will come up with an idea. They know the code, they know what the product can do, they know the team, they know what the team's able to do, and they know the market, or they know something about the, you know, something comes to them and they go, oh, wouldn't that be cool? That's kind of a drastic pivot for this product, but what if it could do that? Right?
Yeah.
And the team comes back and says, yeah, we can have that for you in a sprint. You know, in 2 weeks period of time. And you're like, wow, that's extremely valuable.
Right.
And I've seen that happen on my own, the products that we worked on for, like, you know, from 1998 till about 2004, which is when I started doing more training than anything else. We started, we'd have these events that were spectacular. It was like opening up a whole new market with just a week's worth of changes.
Yeah.
And that kind of thing that we would have otherwise said, we would have been hesitant. Now we're going to have to change an awful lot of code. Things are going to break. Everything's going to blow up and we'll go out of business.
Right.
That doesn't happen.
Yep.
Yeah.
So you have to kind of trust in that. And I don't know exactly the right answer then. I think it just, again, it depends on the team. But I would recommend that teams, you know, do a little bit of research, you know, read my blog, that kind of thing.
We'll put it in the show notes. Yeah,
there we go. And I'm pretty sure I have a post out there that describes these kind of things as they happen in the first person. Every single one of them is like, wow, you know, that was kind of a surprise. The first one was such a surprise. It was like, that'll never happen again in my career. There's no way that could happen again. But then it happens somewhat consistently. So those are the three levels for me.
Yeah.
And then conveying that information to them, that might be enough.
Yeah. I like what you said about habits earlier, but, like, you know, it's a lot of the companies are like, oh, well, you know, they have success with it or something along those lines, but maybe, like, I don't think we will. It's kind of something where it's like you see somebody who's fit and you're like, oh, well, I wish I were that fit, right? But you don't say, like, oh, that person has really good habits, right?
And so, it's all their genetics,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. You blame other things. Like, yeah, it's the culture of the company or something else, right?
But I get my developers won't do that.
Yeah.
And then I talk to the developers and they're like, well, our leadership won't let us do it.
Yeah. Everybody
have you talked
has
to
the
each other?
Story.
Have you met?
Yeah.
It's the other guy. It's the, you know, finger pointing.
Yeah. And I think for me, two things come to mind. One, I second a lot of what you said. You know, you talk about agility, and I think it was an extreme programming conference maybe early on, and the panel was posed a question. If you had to delete one thing, the product code or the test code, what would you delete? And the panel decided they'd delete the product code, because the scenario was a product you'd have to maintain for a while, and the tests would tell them how to rebuild the product and then make them able to change quickly again, right? And so
That's great.
Yeah, and so I think the ability to change, and then you can talk economics, right, and statistics, like defects, how much do defects cost, and that kind of thing. And so David Bernstein's book is one that comes to mind. I can put the book in the show notes that walks through some of the statistics and the scenarios and that kind of stuff. And your book upcoming, might talk about that stuff too.
Hopefully,
but the other thing, part of me is, and I think this is from Martin Fowler or Uncle Bob, but it's almost like if you're a developer and you want to do it, do you need to pitch it to management? Can you just start doing it? And it's just, hey, this refactoring and writing tests is part of being a professional. You know what I mean? Like when a plumber comes and fixes my pipe, he doesn't ask me, hey, is it okay if I do a good job? You know, it's like, you know, sometimes they'll ask those kind of questions, but usually it's like, I expect them to do a good job on what we paid them for.
It'll
cost
you
and
a
so,
bit more.
You know, just start writing tests.
Yeah, I'm a craftsperson.
And then maybe it'll be noticed, hey, there's all these tests running, why? And then it'll come up, but have it come up naturally, right? Yeah. And then you already have an experiment running. This is a little dark, maybe, dark TDD, but...
Sorry to interrupt you, but...
Please,
There's a little bit of an issue with that, in that if you're the only person on a small team who's doing the test-driven development, you're basically working on a safety net for part of the... code.
Yeah.
And anytime anybody works over on the other part, they fall to their death, right?
I knew a person who actually wouldn't commit any of the tests, and so they weren't allowed to write tests, but they wrote tests anyway, but they didn't tell anybody they were doing tests, and it only existed on their machine.
Yeah.
Brutal.
I've had to do that. I had to do that once, and it you know, since they had partitioned the application so that each person was working on their own little area of the code, it was fine. And then of course they went into the test phase and wondered why I went on vacation.
I already know it.
And the only reason why I bring it up is some people make the bar to entry to try it out that has to go up 5 levels of management, and that the CEO says, yes, I bless your ability to do TDD, you know what I mean?
Good point.
Is there ways you can experiment safely without having to justify it, you know, to someone in your company, right?
And I think you're right. I mean, especially if the team or a small team or a small mob said, let's try this out. What's the, we're working towards the benefit of the product. We know and like you said, professionalism. These are professional practices, which goes back to our topic, the thought that I had with our topic, which is, These are practices that you know, you're hiring professional software developers to do professional software development. So you kind of have to trust them to know how to do that. You know, and so if they say we're going to do TDD, well, you know, there's a place for that. And the metaphor that I often use is that of like a sous chef. So if you ever watch any of these, you know, unfortunately, they don't usually show the chefs sharpening their knives, but that was at one time. Now there's an electronic thing that'll do it for you. But in the day, you know, in the olden days, you had to sharpen your own chef's knives, and chefs would take it as a matter of pride that they would sharpen their own knives. And you can imagine that if a chef was sitting there like saying, oh, well, you know, I'm under such time pressure and having to cut these carrots for these 30 people that I'm preparing stuff for, and I've got a dull knife, but oh, well, you know, I'm under a time crunch. And they're going to come up with, you know, different chunks that are going to cook at different speeds, and probably a little bit of blood. And it's just not going to be pleasant.
Yeah.
Take the time to sharpen the knife. And do the job professionally. It's safer, right? It's, you know, more precise, and it's going to taste better.
Yeah.
I get the feeling that if your organization's letting you do mob programming, they'll probably let you do test-driven development.
Do you think?
And if not, then that might also be true in the other direction.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it's definitely, you know, the benefits of communicating through tests and things along those lines have also been a really big thing. And so I've witnessed those kind of 360 quality gains, where it goes from bugs all the time to barely anybody stepping on each other at all, because these tests exist and can, and as a layer of communication. So I always love the idea of tests as communication.
Nice.
Communication format.
So we're almost at our time box, but maybe to hit the last topic from the other end just fairly quickly is, what are some things to do as a leader? Mm-hmm. So we kind of have like a coach in the room, we have a developer in the room, and a leader, right? So official leadership position. What are things to do from a leadership position to help instill practices that you believe would be good for them to try out or something like that?
What would the coach recommend?
This is a tough one because you're in the room and you're like an enlightened leader. You let your teams do mob programming. I would say let them, well, here's the other thing about kind of looping this back to, you know, what does your agile look like, so to speak? If you've got a time box, one of the great advantages of time boxes is that you can run an experiment.
Yeah.
And then at the end of the time box, you can go, well, how did that go?
Yeah.
Right. Do test-driven development for 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. Do pairing, do mobbing, do whatever for 2 weeks. What's going to happen? You know, the worst case is that you don't get anything done for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
But that's not getting anything done for 2 weeks out of what?
Yeah. And, well, and you learn something, right? And that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's like, you know, just to kind of answer the question more directly, I think from my perspective is the, you know, so in many kind of traditional top-down management, it really is like a big difference between theory X and theory Y style management
process. Put it in the show notes.
Yeah, exactly. And please. So you can look at that, and we'll probably make an episode of that at some point. You know, your team's competitive advantage is related to, you know, your team's ability to kind of process new information and pivot and things along those lines, right? And so if you look at like lean startup type stuff or the Joy Inc. type stuff, where it's your competitive advantage is like your learning ability and your ability to change direction, which is fundamentally agility. And so leaders out there, I think, you know, the book Turn the Ship Around talks about like servant leadership as well. So this idea of like servant leadership, focusing on your team's learning and trusting your teams to execute on the right thing, can then, you know, foster that theory Y style, kind of intrinsic motivation stuff. And so I think that's what I would recommend to a new leader, to go down that direction rather than going to kind of like the sociopathic type management styles. And psychological safety and things like that, right? So kind of a lot of stuff that we talk about on the show. So as far as leadership and agility goes, a lot of it is like making sure that the intelligent people are empowered or have the power to make the decisions for things like test-driven development, right? It's like the team can decide whether or not to do it, and experientially over time they will experiment towards and find the right thing that makes your team outperform your competitors. And with being rigid on that just makes you slow to respond to a disruptive innovation in your processes for another company.
Yeah, so I mean, correct me if I'm summarizing this wrong, but it's kind of a epiphany for me a little bit is like, as a leader, you focus on the muscle for the ability to experiment, mm-hmm. inspect and adapt, the ability to learn. And once you have that rolling, basically the teams can discover their own. And just watching you work, I think you do focus on that for the teams, but then you'll come by and drop hints, right? And I think you don't demand it, right? You don't say like, I command you as your leader, you are doing this experiment.
You don't have to do this, but I have a suggestion.
I have a suggestion for you, right? You know, and I think you'll see some people like, no, we're not going to try that. And then some people are like, I'm going to go experiment with that. And then you'll see the practice grow or not grow. But just dropping seeds and giving them the ability to learn what you suggest, mm-hmm. and try it out. You know,
I can see Chris going around to the mobs and doing the turn the ship around kind of thing. So what do you think I'm thinking?
Yeah.
What do you suppose I'm concerned about right now?
Yeah, so with that, I guess we're at our time box. Is there anything you'd like to end with, Rob, or plug before we close it out?
I just wanted to ask Chris if you recall how long Theory Y has been around.
Oh my gosh.
I don't remember either, but
60s?
That's what I kind of think too.
I feel like it's Deming era.
Yeah. So these ideas that Theory X is dead.
Yeah.
TDD is not dead. Theory X should be.
Yeah, well, you know, so people approach things from different styles and everything along those lines, and Theory X was invented to to solve a perceived problem, and so it might be viewed as a stepping stone for society in some way.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, there's definitely you know, if you took the logical extrapolation of having to watch people do work that they get bored by and naturally don't want to do, I don't think software development is in that category. It's a creative pursuit, and people that love doing software development, love automating things, will want to do it more if they're happy doing it. And that's why I think Theory Y works so well in this environment.
And yeah, maybe there's a mesh of Kinefrin and Theory X, Theory Y.
Yeah,
you know, in certain parts of the Kinefrin framework where it's more complex or leaning towards chaos, X is going to be problematic, I feel in the very simple space, maybe it's not dead, you know, Theory X is dead, you know, but I don't know.
Software.
Then if you have the logical extrapolation of saying everybody should have the opportunity to have a creative pursuit and be funded while doing it and things along those lines, and so, you know, automating more and all this other stuff. So, you know, then you have the logical extrapolation of if Theory X were dead, then that means that everybody has the opportunity to pursue the things that they want to and are not in a situation where they're impoverished or hungry or, you know, so really, you know, I'm trying to say software development will get us to world peace and ending world hunger in some way sometime.
Right? Wow. Are we in a pageant?
That's a bold statement.
World peace?
Yeah, we're working towards it. We got to start one mob at a time.
All right.
I'm on the bus with you.
Sounds good. Cool. All right. Nice. So I'll ask again.
Yeah.
Oh, anything you'd like to plug before we end the show?
I've already plugged the book. I've already told you what the name of it is, so I think I'm good.
All right, right on.
Thank you.
Well, thanks for watching. Please like and subscribe or share with anybody you think this will help. And we appreciate the interaction. Come join the discussions on Twitter, on YouTube, or anything else you see us. Until next time, have a good one.
Bye, everybody.
Adios.